when I say an endless prostate orgasm, I probably have like a 20-minute orgasm. But at the same time, the aftershocks lasted an additional 30 minutes. I was getting dinner and I had to have someone else hold the tongs and get me a deviled egg because I physically could not stop shaking.
Welcome to Wild and Sublime, a sexy spin on infotainment, no matter your preferences, orientation, or relationship style. Based on the popular live Chicago show, I chat about sex and relationships with citizens from the world of sex positivity. You'll hear meaningful conversations, dialogues that go deeper, and information that can help you become more free in your sexual expression. I'm sex educator and intimacy coach, Karen Yates. This week, the recording of our live Valentine's Spectacular in Chicago. We discuss intimacy how-tos, pegging, plus what's on your sex bucket list, and more. Keep listening. Do you want to connect with your partner more easily? Download my free publication, Say It Better in Bed, 3 Proven Ways to Improve Intimate Communication. Learn effective things to say and do, leaving the guessing game behind. Whether you're in a long-term relationship or hooking up once, you will come away with simple yet powerful ideas to boost your sexual communication skills. Go to the show notes or karen-yates.com to download your free guide. Hey, folks. So glad to be with you. This has been a very dramatic month for me personally, and I'm very grateful that I'm feeling better than I did 30 days ago when I went through a very shocking series of events. And more on that in a bit. But let me just say, I am feeling super grateful right now to be able to do this podcast and very excited about this podcast. So it is amazing how simply overnight things can change and change your perspective on so much. So today we'll be hearing our recent live February 11th show at Constellation in Chicago. After 3 years, we returned there and it was fantastic to be back. Constellation is a much bigger house than the Hungry Brains cabaret space, so we were able to do the show, plus have some burlesque, and in the second half of the night, after what you'll hear here, we moved into the afterglow, a very delicious mingle, with a tantra demonstration by Goddess Erica with audience participation, Q&A with our panel, an RPG on consent by Rowan Tree, plus vendors such as Tea Time Toys, handmade leather harnesses and accessories by Emma Alamo, Wild and Sublime merch was on sale, plus free Uber Lube samples for everyone. And I got to chat with a number of Patreon members as well. I hope you can make it to the next show. The date will be announced soon. And if you become a Patreon member, you'll know first and get a ticket discount. So now for the episode lineup. Act 1, intimacy how-tos. How do you get closer to someone? How do you get close enough to ask for what you really want? Our panel discusses these issues and more. Act 2. Storyteller and activist R.C. Riley recounts a strong tale of justice and sexual liberation, followed by an interview with the authors of the Pegging Book, here to tell you that the endless prostate orgasms you've heard so much about on Reddit are real, damn it. We'll end with my sermon on the pubic mound, where I go in depth about the recent health emergency that prompted Matthew Amador joining me as MC of the night's proceedings. And I'm so glad he said yes, because he totally rocked the house. This live Wild and Sublime show and my recording today take place on the unceded lands of the Council of Three Fires, the Ojibwe, Odawa, and Potawatomi nations, also colonially known as Chicago. If you want to learn more about the tribal lands you are residing on, there are many resources online to help you do so. We'll now jump right into the show. You'll be hearing some answers to the prompt we gave the audience that night. My number one sex or kink bucket list desire is... Enjoy.
Woo, what a night. I want to talk a little bit about the sponsors for the show. Tonight, for the February live show, Rowan Tree Counseling is our main show sponsor. I want to thank them.
Where are you?
Are you there?
Where are you?
Okay, thank you. And Full Color Life Therapy is our sublime supporter. Thank you, Full Color Life Therapy. So more prompts. My number one kink or sex bucket list desire is abandoning the American workforce to serve the feminine divine full time. Okay. My number one sex or kink bucket list desire is finger cuffs position with two women, two straps, and a dude between us. So that's very complex. I like the imagination. I like that. All right. My number one sex or kink bucket list desire is pegging a dude really good while lecturing and shaming him about his role in the patriarchy. Okay. My number one sex or kink bucket list desire is sex with Denzel Washington. Not a kink, but absolutely something I need before I die. All right. And on that note, still have more to come later. It is time for our panel discussion. Tonight, we have the rules of engagement, how to negotiate the intimacy you want. And on the panel tonight for a very juicy conversation, I'm sure, is sex positive therapist Andy Baumgartner of Rowan Tree Counseling, sex coach Tazima Paris, and sex positive therapist Matthew Amador. Come on up. I realized when I put this topic together, it wasn't until like yesterday that I'm like, whoa, this is really complex. Like when we talk about intimacy, some people think physical intimacy. Other people think emotional intimacy. So I would love to sort of get into both of them tonight. So let's define intimacy. And Andy, why don't we start with you?
Gosh, okay. I think for me, intimacy is one of those things that like, I don't know that I can define it necessarily, but it's like, you know, when you see it, like, you know, yeah,
sure.
When you feel
like
it,
porn.
Right?
Like porn.
Like
yeah.
Porn. Like fetish content, exactly. Yeah. But so in thinking about it, I'm like, well, when I feel it, like, what am I responding to? And I think the things that I'm responding to when I feel it are warmth and trust and connection, mm. Right? So I think those are the things that make up intimacy. Does that count as a definition?
Yeah,
okay.
For sure.
That's what I've got.
Yeah.
So I hold intimacy as the space where anyone, people, humans who are engaging with one another are expressing themselves as accurately as possible and feeling safe to do so. Mm. I think it's that space, that's the space of intimacy, mm. That accuracy of this is the truest I can be at this moment and there being a safe space in which to do that.
Mm. Love that. Matthew.
Yeah, I love that because there is like a familiarity to it. There's a closeness, but it's not just physical. It's not just emotional. It could be spiritual. It could be any aspect of these. And I love how broadly we're all talking about this because a lot of people, I think of intimacy as having to be like capital I intimacy. It has to be like one thing and it has to be heavy. But there can be something so intimate in just being on the couch. Mm. There can also be D2 like dungeon time, yes. But also, it doesn't have to be that. You can also have it just like, yeah, just looking in the refrigerator with each other.
Yeah.
What are we going to snack on?
Snacks are intimate.
So a lot of times people get very afraid, you know, with intimacy, I think comes this, not expectation of vulnerability, but the intimacy and vulnerability kind of go hand in hand. And basically speaking up about what they might need physically or what they might need emotionally. Can you all kind of talk about the various fears that come up for people around speaking about what they need and what they want?
I'll pop in. Part of what is hard about intimacy is that our sexual desires or things that really matter to us are super personal. Like it's not like, oh, the weather, which is impersonal. It's happening to everyone. Our sexual desires or things that are close to our hearts are super personal. And everyone is somewhat concerned about being judged for that. And so it takes crazy amounts of courage, especially in this super shaming society where you can't be fully yourself, or like the fact that flying your freak flag is even a thing means that people don't feel safe to share their true selves. And as I always say, like, you cannot get to the land of intimacy unless you go through the valley of vulnerability. Like, they just go together. Mm-hmm. And so the vulnerability goes with the intimacy because of how personal it is, because of how much we may feel exposed. And if it doesn't feel safe in us first to do that, we're going to probably hold back.
Right. I love this quest, Tazima. Let's go through the valley of vulnerability to get to this Lord of the Rings thing.
Yeah, I'm, get your little backpack.
I'm here for it. Yeah. Come on. Be part of my fellowship.
Let's go.
Absolutely.
You asked about fears. A big one, obviously, is the fear of rejection, right? Mm-hmm. That you're going to make a request or a bid for intimacy, or, you know, tell someone this deep, dark, personal kind of need that you have, and that for whatever reason you'll be rejected, right? Because that person doesn't share that need, that person's not there with you. I think rejection is really scary in those moments, right? That's why it feels vulnerable, is we're, as Tazima said, like, we're exposing a very personal piece of ourselves, and the idea that that might not be returned or might not be met with the same energy is really scary.
Sure, yeah. Sure.
And how often does our brain just play telephone? And when we're being vulnerable with somebody, mm-hmm. and they might not share that same enthusiasm back at us, do we start judging ourselves?
Of course.
They may not even say that directly, but the brain just plays telephone.
Right.
So it can be another layer of just of rejection that we just kind of take on ourselves. It's very brave, yeah.
And I also want to add, in this digital age, there's sometimes these gaps in communication. Like, you may text something that feels vulnerable, or like message someone, and then there's this space. And then what we feel like, because our heritage is anxiety. The anxious ones are the ones who survived, okay? We are the children of anxious humans. And so with that anxiety, like, we just fill that space with our fucking remixed terrors. Like, that's what's happening. And so we're like, and then it usually isn't that bad, but the space in between.
No, meanwhile, they're just like, no, I was driving. Like, I don't know. It's not that deep.
You're like, I see it says red, but that actually says judgment.
That means you hate me. Got it.
So how do we work through these, like, in baby steps, how do we work through the fears of, let's say, it can be with someone you've just met, but it can be someone that you've been with for a while. How do we just start making these different steps, taking baby steps? How do we begin?
Well, yeah, not all of us are fortunate enough to be thrown into a mandatory intimate moment like Keanu Reeves and Sandra Bullock in Speed, or or any, or maybe you have, there's laughter. Maybe that is a very common thing that I'm unaware of. The CTA is bananas, y'all. Or like all of like the Fast and Furious family. Because again, intimacy doesn't have to just be romantic. It can be platonic. It can be a mixture of platonic and romantic. We don't have these dramatic moments to necessarily fall on. I always think that one thing to help take baby steps towards that is self-compassion. Is being able, before you can actually build that house, looking at that foundation within ourselves, to say, hey, am I okay with this? Can I be okay with what I need? Am I okay with saying it out loud?
I think I like to recommend also, just kind of very practically, starting with maybe very small, low stakes asks, right? And in any relationship, right? This doesn't have to be a romantic relationship. It can be familial, it can be a close friend. Low stakes, something as simple as like, I would like a cup of tea. Could you make me a cup of tea, right? Like, I'm feeling thirsty. Could you get me a glass of water? And it feels so simple, but that's the point, right? It's still the same mechanism. It's still voicing a need that you are feeling in yourself.
And I could see how that would be frightening for people, even the, could you make me a cup of tea?
Right. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it is. And if that's where you're at, that's okay, right? But there's a way to start from even there. And so I think if you start with those kind of low stakes asks, A, it's a little bit easier to hear a no. Right. And so I do realize that there's, you know, a huge leap between, can you make me a cup of tea, and like, do you want to go to a swingers party? Right. Like, there's a huge gulf there, and probably there are intermediate steps, but it's the same mechanism. You're still learning how to make a request. You're still learning how to hear maybe no in a way that is not a red light, perhaps, but is an invitation for negotiation, a way that is, yeah, maybe not as emotionally heightened as, do you want to tie me up in public, right? So I think start with small everyday things, ask for them, even when maybe you don't necessarily need them, you would just like them.
So inside of the start, the baby steps and the starting small and low stakes requests, there are a lot of people out here who it's not just scared to ask for help. It's that they've been spending so much time doing everything for everyone else, they don't even know what they want. Mm-hmm. And so literally listing, it's like, okay.
Right, word.
Here's what you do. Make a list of the things you like. And then ask people to participate. If it's that tea, if it's the rope class that you want to attend or whatever. And it might literally be, I want to go to counseling. So it's slowing down. What do I want? What do I need? What do I like? And then starting to share little bits of those things and savoring them for ourselves. Because one thing that comes up when people are making requests that makes small stakes requests even higher stakes is that there's been so much frustration, resentment, lack of satisfaction that it feels terrifying to be rejected again or not get what they want. And so giving that to ourselves first really helps us to manage and diminish the resentment.
It's also so common because so many of us have been brought up, or our brain plays telephone, and we have told ourselves that we have to be able to do this for ourselves. We have to be able to be the one who can do this because we can't trust anybody else. We can't rely on anybody else because there's a history of people being inconsistent. And we need to realize that everybody is thinking this at times in our lives, 99%. Maybe there's this one person who's like, awesome. But we're all, for the most part, feeling this. And there should be no guilt or shame because everybody has these feelings from time to time. Even us. Even us. I don't want to speak for everybody here, but
I'm on it. Yeah.
There we go. Word. Yeah.
It's unanimous.
Yeah. Thank you. There's like a time this week when my partner was like, saw me run around, was like, can I just make you a sandwich? And I was like, yeah. And they're like, Matt, it's no big deal. It's just a fucking, like, so I got a tortilla. I'll wrap some stuff. It's good. And I'm like, no, it's so important. But those little things just really, I have to remind myself, let them happen.
Yeah. So how and when should we talk about what we want? For some folks, that can be insanely vulnerable. Is there a specific time? Should it be in the middle of sex?
No.
I was telling Tazima, I queued this up.
Here we go.
Afterwards, right? It's afterwards.
No.
Afterwards, when they leave the review.
And also, you're both right. So, thanks, man.
I love you.
I love you too. So there's before, during, and after sex. There are different things that you say before, during, and after sex. This seems like it would make sense, but no one does it because people don't have conversations about sex other than with their friends and not with their partners. The before sex conversation is planning kind of requests. And even before the before conversation, you have to have the before conversation with yourself. That is your yes, no, maybe list. What are you a yes to? What are you an absolute no to? What's a maybe that conditions may support you being able to have it be a yes? Okay. Once you have that, you can come together and have that before. Here's what I want to do. Most people don't have a conversation about sex and what they want to do before they have sex. They just think it's supposed to be the wordless montage that they see in the movies where no one farts or sweats or has to change position because they're getting a cramp. Okay? That's not real. During sex, there are more like adjustments, like I'm getting a cramp all the time. Or let's try the thing that's on the maybe list. Those are the things that you say during the sex, but keep it super simple so that you don't take each other out of the moment and the sensation. If you get too intellectual, like, do you like this? Do I like this? That's over. Then after sex is where you give feedback and make new requests. And the feedbacks might sound like, I really liked this thing and that thing that we tried, I really don't like it and I don't ever want to have it again, ever. Or I want more of XYZ. And then you can also make new plans for the next time you're going to engage with this person. So this is a whole way of being that is not even a thing that people even really talk about, but sex communication can be really, really super helpful, and it can create intimacy. It can create connection, that sense of belonging and not being weird inside the sex. If you have this good, high quality communication, like, then like so many things can happen. You can be in the flow. It doesn't have to be like hiccupy, but even if it's hiccupy, you can laugh about it. By the way, if you're not laughing during sex, you're not just.
Sex is hilarious. It's hilarious.
Sex is really funny.
People frequently laugh at me while I'm having sex. It's true.
Where can I sign up to watch?
Is there an OnlyFans for that?
Right. There we go.
I then ask what you should do if you ask for something that could be both surprising and unwanted by the other person.
This is really tough. This is a really hard place to be in, I think. If you are in a monogamous relationship where you bring a desire to your partner and there's a no, or there's even a, I don't know, I think that's really tough. I think one of the things you can do, and I'll be interested to hear what Matthew and Jazima have to say, because this is, I think, really complicated, but I think perhaps you talk about, you know, okay, well, I'm not into that thing necessarily, but what is the emotional state that you're trying to achieve from that? Or what is the thing about it that appeals to you? And here is the thing that I'm not sure appeals to me, because I think for a lot of things, they aren't necessarily a monolith, right? Like maybe you're not into impact, right? But maybe you're not into impact in public, or maybe you're not into impact in a certain context. Maybe there are places that the interest overlaps or that can work. Maybe we need to boil it down to an emotional state that you're hoping to reach. And maybe there's another way that we can achieve that for you. Maybe. Yeah, I'm not sure. I'm interested to hear.
For those who don't know what impact is, it means play that includes spanking or striking,
paddles.
Hitting, paddles.
Sorry.
Impact play. It is super vulnerable, and getting a no can feel really scary. And I think it's important that we identify what is the no, because it might not be a blanket no. Or it might not be a blanket not. It might be a no for now. It might be a temporal thing where I'm not ready at this moment, or there's a condition that needs to be met. But this is a better conversation to be had while clothes are on.
Yeah.
Like, but if it happens, you know, during sex, you can still decline and say, let's talk about it later, though.
I think that's really important when you're making a request, particularly if it's out of nowhere, and hopefully if your clothes are on, but that you expect to perhaps not reach an agreement in that first conversation, right? That you expect for each other to need space to sit with it, to consider it, to research it, to really understand their own yes or no, right? So I think it's helpful if you can come into that first conversation expecting that there will be a second conversation.
And also, if someone asks something of you, at any time, if it's been discussed previously or this is just like in the middle of it, you can always change your mind.
Yes.
You can say, okay. And then, but that doesn't mean it's an absolute. You can always change your mind.
What is the line like between them willing to try something new and the hard no, or like, I'm not sure how I feel about this, but I'm not going to know until I'm in it. This is where consent comes in, right? Mm-hmm. But like this idea, I love this, like we can always change our mind, right?
I think this space of the figuring it out on the fly is a skill that you can build of how do I feel right now? What's going on for me right now? This is not something that most people are good at because of how we've been shamed about our feelings, shamed about our opinions, shamed about saying no to people or like, go hug your auntie. We train children to not have their body autonomy. And so we're out of touch with our bodies. And so getting in touch with that little like, something doesn't feel right. Like listen to that thing, because that's letting you know some information, important data about how you feel about the situation. So yes is feel a certain way in your body. No's feel a certain way in your body. And the maybe or the I need more information also has a sensation in your body. Your body is incredibly wise. This takes some self-work to be able to know that. this is not, what we're talking about are some advanced concepts. And like, if you don't have the support to get there, it can be really challenging to like figure this out on your own.
But I'd also like to say that these types of ambiguous moments where you're really figuring them out, these are the moments that will also build intimacy. Give them a round of applause. Thank you so much.
If you'd like more information on Andy Baumgartner from Rowan Tree Counseling, Matthew Amador, and Tazima Paris, go to the show notes. Do you want to create a podcast but feel a little overwhelmed? Can I suggest Buzzsprout as the easiest and best way to launch, promote, and track your podcast? Buzzsprout is a podcast host with both free and paid plans. By using them, your podcast gets listed in all major podcast directories like Apple, Spotify, Google, and more. And you get a website. They are great with support, and I especially love them because their newsletter and podcast offer tons of tips for growing your pod. A friend recommended them to me, and now I am recommending them to you. And if you say that Wild and Sublime sent you by clicking on our affiliate link in the show notes, you get $20 and we get $20, which is a pretty good deal. Go to the show notes to begin. We now return to the second half of the episode where Matthew Amador takes over as MC. You'll be hearing a rich story told by the accomplished R.C. Riley, then a probing interview, sorry, on pegging with authors of The Pegging Book, Cooper Beckett and Lindsay Miller, followed then by my sermon on the pubic mound where I discuss the recent dramatic events in my life. Enjoy.
We have some more prompts. My number one sex or kink bucket list desire is a project managed orgy. Some spreadsheets going on. You'll excel at that one. Huh? Yeah, grown it up. My number one sex or kink bucket list desire is prolonged heavy rubber encasement. There we go. That's it. My number one sex or kink bucket list desire is being in the middle in a male-male-female daisy chain. Like you found my letters, I read each one out loud. We have another performer coming up next. Our next artist is a performer, activist, and podcast host seeking to empower the marginalized. On their journey, they began writing as a means of healing and are here tonight as a survivor to tell us how justice is best served by a sexually liberated warrior human. Yes, right? Those are some words. Please give it up for the extremely talented R.C. Riley.
Thank you for that, Matthew. I appreciate that intro. Let me see if I can live up to all of that. When my niece was a teenager, she used to say to me, "Auntie, it's not my fault that grown men look at me." You see, she was quite developed as a teen, and this auntie couldn't handle the responsibility of unwanted attention on her. She grew angry and frustrated with me, and by the time she was in her 20s, she came to tell me, "Auntie, I don't think you were being fair when I was younger. I shouldn't have been punished, silenced, or shamed because of what some ignorant, toxic grown man might say or do to me." Now, in hindsight, I agree. But at the time, all I could think was that as her supposed protector, I couldn't bear the thought of someone dismissing me to harm her emotionally, physically, or sexually, because it happened to me. By the time my niece turned 30, I had shared this story that occurred while she was younger. I remember one day while out on a date with a woman, a man walked over to my displeasure, ignoring our obvious hand-holding and gentle touches that demonstrated that we were together. He began to hit on her and overlooked me effortlessly. I politely asked that he refrain from interrupting. Mid-sentence, he yanked me from my seat, pulled me to the door, and told me to never try and stop a grown man. Did I understand? He was stronger. He proved that. But what he was really showing was that because his humanness was represented as a male, he was supposed to be with a she, and she was not supposed to be with me. If a stranger would so boldly disregard the essence of me, how much more disregard might he have for a teenage mini-me? I know you all are thinking at this point in the story that you didn't come to hear this, but hold up, wait a minute. I know you're really thinking, come on, let's talk about sex, baby. But can you indulge me for a moment as I digress? I'd like to share a few things that if you aren't paying close attention, you might just miss. Yes, I'm Black and I'm proud. That's quite obvious. Sure, I've been known to chant, I'm queer and I'm here. But I also want to share for your delight that I shout in ecstasy for hallelujahs and orgasms alike. And for that trivia question of what does RC really like, the answer isn't as obvious, so I'll give you this one. I love music just as long as it's grooving. Now that was your praise break in case you missed your cue. For me, my praise, my pain, and my power are profoundly connected. Some might even say intertwined. I was a survivor turned warrior human who was deeply wounded emotionally. And it just so happens that one of the weapons I acquired during my healing journey is my strong, centered, and unapologetic sexuality. Does that frighten you? No way. Oh, it does most. But let me school you for a moment before I'm ghost. A weapon can be used to defend with or without harm to another. It can also be used to protect, to shield, and to ensure justice for each other. During my healing journey, others ridiculed me for being unsure of who to love and for choosing to date twice my age above. I was learning and growing and developing my skills. And today, I am not afraid to bring myself pleasure first and then others' thrills. Now, before your dirty mind starts to go down the wrong path, let me just say that if you know what you're doing, you don't have to engage in conventional sex to make someone confess that they love you enough to want to drink your bath water. Initially, my pain made me want revenge. Then I heard the voice of the divine say clear and fiercely, "Vengeance is mine." Now, if you follow my socials, you may notice I shout praise God from whom all blessings flow, then holler vagina, non-binary masturbation, and clitoris, don't you know? Some call me contradictory. They say, how can she profess to love God and live so frivolously? At that, I scoff, for my frivolity is none of their damn business unless they're trying to get with me. I say I was designed by the divine to be just who I am. I mean, how many other sexy, gorgeous Black queer humans are standing at this mic with me. You see, I stand here confidently so that those who have felt marginalized, left out, and forgotten by society can see that what others try to snuff out, their spirit, their shine, and their destiny will still be. I seek and I fight for justice for those who may be too afraid or ashamed to stand here next to me. I speak for those who have been ridiculed by friends, shamed by family, and cast out of faith communities. I stand here on the second Saturday of Black History Month to say to my niece, other young girls and young women, I will fight to make this world a place where you can walk comfortably in a tight t-shirt, low-rise jeans, a crop top, or naked, and be respected, accepted, and understood by more than our higher power and me. Thank you.
Give it up one more time, RC Riley. Also available for speaking engagements. Please go to their website for information about that. Thank you so much. Thank you for just what a winning example of how other people put shame on us. That shame thrives in silence. You brought something into the light. And it does not have the power over us anymore. Thank you so much. Thank you so much. Now, you ready for some butt stuff? This side, you ready for some butt stuff? You all ready for some butt stuff? Alan, I see, I know you are. You ready for some butt stuff over here? Okay, because now we have Cooper Beckett and Lindsay Miller, who have written a fantastic book about pegging, asking all the important questions. How do I do it? What tools do I need? Will it make me gay? All things Mike Pence asked when downloading the Taylor Swift album. So without further ado, I bring on Cooper Beckett, Lindsay Miller, right there, and the incomparable Karen Yates.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Loved the book. So let's talk about the, I mean, I would say that probably 90% of the people in this room know about how the word pegging came about, but in case you don't, how did the word pegging come about?
Well, a long time ago. There's a lot of controversy surrounding Dan Savage. And so we don't want to give him credit for the word.
Never.
But what he did was he polled his audience. Apparently, he did not like the word pegging because he has an aunt named Peg. And so tried to push it away from the poll. It won anyway.
He wanted to find a word for a strap on a cis female strap, because at the time there was like he was like cis
it was
female.
Very specific
was, yeah
cis, very heteronormative at
very
the time.
Heteronormative yeah. Cis female strap on dildo into a cis male's anus.
Yes.
Okay. And this is what
it was, the weirdest, most specific sex act ever
that he had gotten a lot of questions about.
He'd gotten
yeah,
a lot.
So he needed a word. He needed a word.
Everyone wanted to do it, but it was very specific.
So this is the interesting question. That my first question is, Lindsay, do you think Dan Savage was picking up on a cultural zeitgeist, and that's, or did he kind of move it along? I mean, the fact he was getting so many letters, is this what was?
Yeah, I think that was the catalyst of needing a word, because he was getting so much through his advice column. He was getting so many questions and he needed something to refer to it as. And yes, he didn't come up with the word. I think his choice was punting, which I was
yeah,
like,
yeah, which doesn't.
Nope, not great. Doesn't not great. Doesn't work. But
I
yes.
Really nail it.
No. But no, yeah. So he created the poll that eventually came up with the word pegging.
Yes.
So how much of gender and power is at the heart of the Ooh. Pegging act?
There's like six chapters in there about this. it's really a strange thing because it is so specific in its original definition that it is a cis woman wearing a strap-on. Pegging is fucking a cis man. We really had to, as we were writing it, we had to unlearn some of our own biases around the gendered aspect of it, because really it's about connecting to an area that people are often very afraid to connect with, the butt. And, you know, especially the masses of men in this country who are really overwhelmed by the idea, whether it's, you know, it is really fun to make fun of people who are afraid of being gay when they peg, but at the same time, it is a legitimate thought simply because it's been pounded into us. And I realized that as I was saying it, that is only for this subset of our society. So if you enjoy this, you must acknowledge your gayness.
Right.
And we really wanted to make a concerted effort to de-gender the term because, and we, you know, we are, the title of our book is A Complete Guide to Anal Sex with a Strap-on Dildo. We don't need to say that it's about a man or a woman, that it's about a cis person or not. And we wanted to recognize that non-binary people exist and
yes.
They get to peg too, you know? So yeah, we wanted to take gender out of the equation.
And at the same time, we chose to use a term, the pegging book, the term doesn't need to exist. It can just be anal sex. It can just be strap-on sex. But because it exists, we recognize that the audience that needed to hear our voice would only buy it if they thought it was this.
Right.
If we made too big a deal about the fact, well, everybody can do it, they don't feel as special, so they're not going to give us money. And they're not. And if they don't give us money and they don't read the book, they're not going to hear the things that they need to be hearing, which is that it isn't necessarily gendered.
So let me ask you this. On the cover, it says anal sex with a strap-on dildo. Let's talk. What is the difference? Yeah. And what I like is just you can just stick this in your back pocket.
It's a little book.
It's very easy.
It's a very cute little book about a very big pop.
Very cute. How do you really define, in terms of power, gender, what have you, the difference between strap-on play and just like dildo play, just like insertion? Like, what's the difference there?
Well, one is it's attached, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the no, object I mean, of a harness does kind of like attach it to your body in a way that sometimes is actually feels more like it's part of you.
Yeah.
So that could be a connection element into the sex play that can be very different than holding it with your hand.
Right. Gets back to the power.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, and there's the difference between the extension of your hand and the extension of yourself.
It's like being a wizard.
Very much. Yes. Yeah. To go back to the Lord of the Rings thing. Yeah. But it's coming from your midsection. And the midsection is where most of the sex tends to happen.
As a somatic educator, I'm loving this. Yeah. Yes, the midsection.
The mid area, this area here.
Yes.
And so it's just, you know, there's a lot of discussion about what the value is for the pegger. Because it is not a sensation device, generally. The dildo cannot send the neurons and all that information back into you. But at the same time, it is that you are making a bodily connection. And I think that's the part that makes it important.
So let's talk about the P spot, you know, as opposed to the G spot. What is it? What is the P spot? And how is it different than a prostate exam? Like when you're doing P-spot massage.
Well, as someone who's had a prostate exam, the doctor wanted to get it over as quickly as possible, so he lubes and he pokes. That's it. There is nothing worse than a pokey butt play. And nobody in that situation wants to enjoy it. Nobody. Therefore, the prostate, it's this part of the body that we only really think of when you're an older man and you need to get a check because it might self-destruct on you and cause cancer. But at the same time, you know, we talk a lot about the fact that we're not doctors in this book. But we acknowledge the fact that in the womb, everyone was the same. And then at some point, ovaries descend and become testicles, or they stay ovaries. The clit tries to get as far away from the body as possible and becomes the penis. We are all the same. Therefore, the prostate has no purpose in the female body, but it tends to feel exactly like the G-spot. So if we make the acknowledgement that the G-spot and the prostate are basically the same thing, and as someone who's had my fingers in a man and a woman at the same time and felt both become engorged and both feel like that squishy walnut, it's the same fucking thing, which means we both have a major pleasure center. And in general, men are just ignoring it.
So I want to talk, Lindsay, before we get on to like the extended orgasm that massaging a prostate can give you. I had Sarah Dysack on the show a couple of months ago, and she was talking about how butt play was basically the great untold story of the pandemic. And you are an educator at the Tool Shed, correct? Up in Milwaukee?
Yes. Yeah.
And I think I was reading in the book that there was a lot of anal sex classes that they just kept selling out, correct?
Yes. So Cooper and I had initially had a class at the Tool Shed, which is an erotic boutique in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And we always sold out. Yeah, it's a small store. We could have like 30, 40 people basically, but we always sold out every time we had the class. And during the pandemic, that was when we decided, oh, we could make it an online class or we could write a book. And then we decided to go the book route. But yeah, there has been an interest for as long as I've been working there, which is a good solid 12 years. And oftentimes it'll be folks coming in as a couple whispering about like, we've been thinking about pegging or we've been thinking about butt stuff. We want to buy a harness, our first toy together, you know. And yeah, it's been increasing. I think as it's been more popular in like pop culture, it's been in movies, it's been on TV
and
shows.
You have a list of movies.
We have a list of good and bad representation in movies and TV shows. They're mostly bad, actually. Almost all of them are bad. But there are a few great ones. And so as that has becoming more popular, as the term has becoming more popular, we have been getting a lot more customers interested in pegging and even just trying it out. You know?
Yeah.
And in the pandemic, you get bored.
You do.
There's not a lot to do.
There wasn't.
So.
That's right.
What if we put something in your butt?
That's right.
A lot of people worked from home, and I think they kind of got that like nooner energy that was lost, and so they were able to have a lot more sex at random times. You know?
So the very first time I read about this endless prostate orgasm was in a certain someone's book on swinging.
I don't know what you're talking about.
I remember I was just like, what? Cooper, can you talk a little bit about this? When I've told guys about this, they're like, no, that's not possible. It can't happen. So I mean, seriously.
Do they sound just like that when they say it?
It's this automatic, like, I can't. There's no way I'll ever be able to have an orgasm like a woman. You guys can just come and come and come and come. I can't do that. And I'm like, yes, you can. Cooper Beckett said so.
I like that I come up in your sex play.
Right.
Okay, I had heard, I've had a podcast for a long time about non-monogamy, and I had heard of a prostate orgasm, but nobody I knew had ever had one. I knew a lot of women who had squirting orgasms and the endless cycle of the squirting orgasm. But then Tristan Cherimino, who wrote the foreword for our book, told me, yes, I've seen it. I've made it happen. So yes, it's possible. And then I did a yearly trip. Unfortunately, it has come to an end, but I did a yearly trip to Desire Resort in Mexico, which is sandals for swingers. And I was demonstrating one toy for one friend, and I had the request, do you need anything? And I said, well, I have a butt plug. Would you like to put it in for me? Because I'm focused on this other thing. And she said, yeah, don't worry. I'm a professional. And I didn't know what that meant, but I continued with what I was doing. And she started doing what she was doing, which was not just putting the butt plug in, but manipulating it and rhythmically and regularly. And I started, well, getting distracted from what I was doing. And my partner, who I was playing with, said, you know, I'm fine. You should just lay down. And so I did, and she kept going. And
I know everyone's on the edge of their seats.
The best way I can explain it is it was like a wave breaking, but the shore kept moving back. And so the wave just kept breaking. And for me, that manifests as full body shudders, like full muscle tension and relax and tension and relax. And when I say an endless prostate orgasm, I probably had like a 20-minute orgasm up on the top of this building in Mexico, which is impressive, 20 minutes. But at the same time, the aftershocks lasted an additional 30 minutes. I was getting dinner, and I had to have someone else hold the tongs and get me a deviled egg because I physically could not stop shaking. And I asked her, it's like, okay, that was a prostate orgasm, right? And she's like, well, fuck, yeah, it was a prostate orgasm. So one of the most amazing things to me is that, and I can ask Lindsay to convert, I don't like to speak for women, but the women I know who've had squirting orgasms said at first it was difficult to get to, but then it started to connect itself to other types of orgasms. And I found that to be true with the prostate orgasm. The shaky orgasm started only with very specific stimulation and then just started to connect itself to other types of orgasms. Like I can have one with just general body stimulation. I believe one time during the pandemic, I said, Hell, the prostate just came online. All right. Because it can happen unexpectedly. And because it's not an ejaculatory orgasm, your body doesn't turn off afterwards, because that's what evolutionarily we do after an orgasm. We shut down and relax. But with a prostate orgasm, it just keeps going. And if you coax it a little bit more, it goes a little bit more. It's unbelievable, and that's why I became a proselytizer, and I know the word is fun there, for prostate orgasms, because I firmly believe that, well, I mean, we'd all be a lot happier if we had a lot more orgasms, but it's something so valuable and so incredible that men are just ignoring because of stigma.
So let's take this from, you know, Mount Olympus and just kind of bring it back down to basics for the folks who really haven't explored much. And so, Lindsay, what would you say, like, what is the easiest way to just begin exploration, keeping a low bar?
Especially for folks who haven't explored the butt at all, like a butt plug. Oh, and actually, even before that, before you spend any money, you come with factory installed sex toys, and they're called fingers, you know? Like, so if you're a little squicked out about finger play, put a glove on, but you've got plenty of, you know, most of us have fingers that we can play with and we can use to manipulate the anus, the prostate, if you have one. And that's a good way to introduce the butt to play, to stimulation, and then maybe move into wearing a butt plug during other sex play, during intercourse, during oral sex, maybe wearing a vibrating butt plug to have a little bit more stimulation, and just kind of connect the wires in your brain to something in the butt to pleasure. Because oftentimes that wire doesn't exist for some folks, you know, like, so it only is connected to other things, to prostate exams that aren't sexual at all. So to start connecting those wires and rewiring your brain to think like, this is hot. The Pavlovian response of like, okay, I'm going to play with this and I will orgasm during play, or I'll orgasm after play. And so that's a good place to start. Again, finger play, small butt plug, and working your way up to something like a dildo or a toy of some kind, or more fingers.
Yeah, this
fingers.
Isn't a, we want to do this tonight, so let's go buy something and then do right. it tonight.
Right.
This is a longer process.
This is a, yeah, this is a very long process.
It can
process.
Be, yeah.
It can mm-hmm. be, yeah. And lube.
Oh, lube. Definitely lube.
Oh, God, yeah.
Two most important things are communication and lubrication.
Okay. Very good. So the Pegging book, you can get it on Amazon. You can get it on the Wild and Sublime affiliate link on bookshop.org.
Oh,
yeah, I know. I jumped on that one right away. So it is around. The Pegging book, highly yes. recommend. Thank you, Cooper Beckett. Thank you, Lindsay Miller. Appreciate
Thank
it.
You.
Thank you.
The things I did not realize I would learn from that interview. One, post-sex, grab the tongs, get a deviled egg. Light bulb moment. Light bulb moment. Also, I never thought of it, but as someone who has a runaway clit. Thanks for that jargon. Makes so much sense now. So, some people need no introduction. And I'm here to prove that I guess that's not the case for the next person I'm bringing up on stage. For the past 5 years, she has been the host and producer of Wild and Sublime. She is a somatic sex educator who works with couples to expand intimate communication skills, to bring more pleasure into their lives. And if you have at all listened to the Wild and Sublime podcast, you know that she has a very, very promising career ahead of her in ASMR. Please, please, please give it up for Karen Yates and her sermon on the pubic mound.
Oh my goodness. As I was putting this show together, and then especially today, I was thinking about all of the ways that this show tonight interconnect. So we have the Pegging book, and then we have the vendors, you know, Tea Time Toys and Emma Alamo. So we've got this whole butt, lovely butt theme going. But then, you know, a while ago, I got Tazima Paris and Matthew Amador and Andy Baumgartner on for this intimacy panel. And as I was putting my sermon together today, I thought, wow, talking about intimacy, and that is so up for me in my life right now, being intimate. And the reason I am being confronted with intimacy right now is that about 3 weeks ago, I had a really major health emergency. I didn't know it, but I had a seizure and I went to the hospital. My very good friends came to my aid. They actually did a wellness check on me because I had not shown up at a Zoom gathering that I show up every single week. And they took me to the emergency room and found out that I had a benign, but a brain tumor. And I got operated on 36 hours later. This happened so quickly, out of the blue, didn't see any of this coming. And what was so incredible about this event for me is how people mobilized in my life to take care of me. I'm single, I have very little family. And, you know, my best friend and all of my other close friends just came together. They had an actual summit meeting while I was in the hospital. And through all of this, there was this feeling coming up in me as people were helping me because, hey, you know, when you're in charge of a lot of things, guess what? It's kind of hard being intimate and vulnerable, right? So, you know, my friend is like, give me the passcode to your phone. I was kind of like, what? But then I was like, oh, okay. Like, it was like this like weird liminal state of like, I don't want to have people help me, but I'm so fucked up right now. People have to help me. And so people are like, oh my gosh, we're gonna get together and clean your apartment. And I was like, what? This is crazy. People are putting all of these plans together for my benefit. And so I couldn't remember things, and that felt so weird to tell people, like, I can't remember what I told you an hour ago. But long story short, the operation really, really went well. Obviously, it happened 3 weeks ago, and I'm sitting here now doing this show. And, you know, I was like, today, I was like, man, I was kind of maybe it was a little dumb doing the show. But then I was like, no, and I was sitting backstage. I'm like, oh, I really love being here and I really love doing the show. So it ended up being good. But like what I'm realizing about being intimate and vulnerable is that I always wanted to be here. I always wanted to be intimate and vulnerable. But I didn't know how. I was chipping away at it year after year. You know, I was trying things, working in therapy and doing all sorts of different things. But to have a major health crisis or something really major in your life landing you in a place where you basically have to be intimate, have to be vulnerable, it's a little mind-blowing. But there is this aspect I'm also realizing about vulnerability, is that you have to really make a decision to receive. There is something in being vulnerable about when you're opening yourself up, it's frightening, but you're also basically saying, I'm willing to receive. And that's a sea change for me. That is an absolute sea change. I went on Facebook the other day. I don't spend a lot of time on Facebook, but I was like, okay, I've got this circle of friends who've been wonderfully supportive, but I'm willing to tell other people. I'm willing to tell the next 1,200 friends that I have on Facebook about what has happened because I'm like, this is really fucking important. And I laid the story out in a fairly non-dramatic way, as much as a brain tumor can be non-dramatic. But the response I got was amazing. People contributing, you know, they brought meals, words of encouragement. And I cried because these sorts of things, well, we so rarely have these events happen in our life when we understand what we mean to other people. So Later in earlier this afternoon, I should say. And by the way, one thing that has definitely happened is as my brain is healing, I'm having to speak slower because things don't come out the way I want them to come out. I was in the basement of my apartment building, and I was walking through the laundry room, and I suddenly had this quiet sentence come into my head, which was, "I am worthy." And I had never had that sentence come into my head, and at such depth. And I realized it was something got reorganized inside of me. When I heard something that I thought was, oh, sure, I'm worthy. But then when you really feel it, like, oh, I don't think I ever really thought I was worthy. And I was thinking about how with work and with sex, a lot of us show up and we're camouflaging the fact that we feel intrinsically unworthy. And so we do a lot of stuff maybe that we don't want to be doing to hide this feeling of unworthiness. And as this drama unfolds in my life, I can feel these layers sort of unpeeling. And I'm aware of these new awarenesses, even in 3 weeks, I know they're going to continue, of just things coming up as I continue to need to ask for help. And I want to end on a funny story because this is kind of serious. I went to see my neurosurgeon last week to get my pathology reports. Okay, that's not funny, but it was scarier than shit. But it was benign, as I said. And so we were kind of winding down the interview. He's like, so you want to ask me any other questions? And I said, yeah, I want to ask about orgasm. Because I interviewed this guy for the podcast a couple of months ago about this documentary movie he made called The Sexplanation, where they're doing research that orgasms are a whole brain activity. And what I want to know is, can I have an orgasm? Is that okay? Is it going to be okay for me to have an orgasm? And he looked at me and he's like, and I couldn't see his face. He was kind of frozen the way neurosurgeons are when they just start listening to you. So I couldn't see half of his face. And he's like, yes, as long as you don't strain. And I'm like, what is he? I'm like, oh yeah, you're a dude. You're a dude. Do you strain? Because I don't strain. But I went home and I'm just kind of sat with it. I'm like, okay, he cleared me for an orgasm. Okay. Clear to have an orgasm. And a couple of days passed. And I was like, yeah, well, I don't want to have an orgasm now. A couple of days passed. And then suddenly one day I'm like, yeah, I'd really like to have an orgasm. But I'm like, wait. Okay, wait. Is this going to kill me? Shit. No, he cleared me. He's a neurosurgeon. He cleared me for orgasm. So I'm like, okay. So I pull out my like favorite, easiest sex toy. Not a very dramatic one, but it's like, this is a getter. This one's going to get me to where I need to go. And I'm like, okay, here we go. Let's go. We're going to start real slow because this could kill you. No, it's not going to kill me. It's not going to kill me. And I'm like, but if it does kill me, what a way to go. Oh, yeah. Okay, that's not funny. So I'm starting. I'm like, okay, I'm feeling good. And I'm coming. And it's like, yes, I'm coming. I'm still alive. And I'm like, oh, yeah, I'm still alive. And I'm like, that's it. I'm alive. We're alive. We can have orgasms. Yes. Thank you.
If you'd like to help with the operating expenses of this podcast, which I would be profoundly grateful for due to the mounting medical bills I'm experiencing, you can leave a one-time tip or become a monthly Patreon member by following the links in the show notes. To purchase the Pegging Book, go to our bookshop.com affiliate link. And for more information on R.C. Riley, go to our show notes or the episode webpage on wildandsublime.com. Well, that's it, folks. Have a very pleasurable week. Thank you for listening. If you know someone who might be interested in this episode, send it to them. Do you like what you heard? Then give us a nice review on your podcast app. You can follow us on social media at Wild and Sublime and sign up for newsletters at wildandsublime.com. I'd like to thank associate producer Julia Williams and design guru Jean-Francois Gervais. Theme music by David Ben-Porat. This episode was edited by the Creative Imposter Studios. Our media sponsor is Rebellious Magazine, Feminist Media, at rebelliousmagazine.com.